From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The New York Times recently exposed how Justice Department officials in 2018 candidly discussed Trump's immigrant family separation policy as a deterrent to a migrant influx. Former U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions in particular reportedly said, "We need to take away children." The report is based on a draft written by the DOJ's Inspector General Michael Horowitz, and it reflects the dehumanization of migrants from beyond the southern border, historically and today. We turn now to a well-known Salvadoran American writer who links through his own story the repercussions of years of U.S. policies. Roberto Lovato's new book is called Unforgetting, a memoir of family, migration, gangs, and revolution in the Americas. Roberto is a journalist and a member of the Writers Grotto. He's one of the country's leading writers and thinkers on Central American gangs, refugees, violence, and other issues, and co-founder of Dignidad Literaria, the national movement formed to combat the invisibility and silencing of Latinx stories and books in the U.S. publishing industry. Welcome to the program, Roberto.
Happy to be with you, Sonali, once again, after so many years.
Yes, and I should say you're also a longtime friend of the show, but it has been a very long time, far too long since we had you on our program. Congratulations on the book. This is, it seems, a culmination of, you know, a lifetime of the political work you've done, but also the writing that you've done. Tell me what it was that led you to write your memoir. You're not that old, Roberto.
Actually, I am that old. I'm going to be 57 in about a month.
That is young by today's standards.
Well, thank you. Bless you for that, my dear. I embarked actually, really, you know, in your intro, I've been carrying 30 years of stories about Central Americans, especially about Central American children. They've played an outsized role in my life. In many ways, not just my family, but those that I've known and those that I've seen, you know, and if you want to measure like politics, you want to measure fascism, the way that a society treats children is a strong indicator of that. I've always known that from you know, visiting El Salvador when it was a military dictatorship, a fascist military dictatorship. So carrying these stories for 30 years, some friends in Texas invited me to go give a speech at a conference, and these friends, being Salvadoran and conspiratorial as my people are, conspiratorial in a good sense, and you can read in my book what that means, invited me, also ended up taking me down to Karnes, Texas, to one of those immigration prisons that the Obama administration had built, you know, in the furthest reaches of South Texas, so that journalists and community advocates couldn't go there. So, you know, I'm here in this immigrant prison with this child and his mother, and the child tells me, you know, in the tenderest voice, sweetest voice, the most horrific and hard realities that there are in this life about death and killing. And I don't want to trigger your reader, just let us say it was horrific. And this child telling me this and looking the child in the eyes just made me spill, you know, the dam of myself overflowed, and I decided at that moment, okay, I'm going to do something about this, and I'm going to tell the stories behind these stories of abuse of Central American children, right? Because Jeff Sessions, Bill Barr, Donald Trump, Barack Obama, Jay Johnson, they've all been party to the industry of destruction of Central American children. And so I decided, you know, I was going to spill my beans and tell this story, and I embark on this journey into the past in many ways, into the forgotten past, which is why I call the book Unforgetting.
The book is not just political, but it's personal, it's poetic, and I'm wondering if you can read a section from the book to give our audience a taste of the writing.
Absolutely. I have a part in the epilogue where I'm trying to understand, put everything together, because I've got, you know, these different time periods that I've woven together like my grandmother on her Singer sewing machine. And so I'm here at a cafe trying to make sense of everything that I've been through in the writing and in the actual adventure of the life that I've lived. And so I'm sitting at my favorite table at Cafe La Boheme on 24th near Mission with my laptop in front of me, attempting to stitch together the disparate pieces of my origins as I write this book. The varnished oak tabletop sits on the base of an antique sewing machine. Its 12 by 10 inch iron treadle and the iron gears it powers still in place. Even though there's no longer a sewing machine above, the pedal of the moves the metal beast lying below most customers' awareness. Its black latticed elegance and noisy rotation remind me of bouncing on the lap of Mamate, the Salvadoran seamstress whose máquina de coser fueled her family's 3,000 mile journey to San Francisco. Pushing the pedal slowly, I start typing. The pin attached to the pedal of the sewing machinery below pushes and pulls the treadle wheel. To the annoyance of the techie sitting next to me, it squeaks every few revolutions, but still the wheel turns. Up and down, up and down, up and down, the 1, 2, 3, 4 motion of my foot working the treadle hypnotizes me. Next to the wheel, in the center of the space below the table, sits the machine's wrought iron logo, slightly rusty silver, and faded black laurels garnishing the Art Deco letters spelling the Singer sewing machine. Coming here is a ritual of mine, something about coming to the neighborhood of my birth to write atop an old Singer sewing machine in a cafe named for the romantic opera La Boheme makes it easier to recover the fragments of my childhood and adolescent memories, especially the ones that are often more painful to conjure. I look out the window and up the street towards Horace Mann, my old junior high school, and I remember the shame, confusion, and molten anger I felt as a kid.
My guest is Roberto Lovato, reading from his new book, Unforgetting, a memoir of family, migration, gangs, and revolution in the Americas. You open your book with talking about your own father. And you, of course, you came to this country as a child of, or you are a child of immigrants, I should say, an American whose past, whose ancestry is very much in the news today, considering that the majority of our migration is now from Central America, from Central American countries like El Salvador. But all we hear from President Trump about Central America and what it represents are violent gangs like MS-13. Tell me about the memories that you write about in your book regarding gangs and gang violence and these people that have been demonized, but are, of course, people, human beings.
Yeah, Donald Trump and Bill Barr and actually a lot of my peers in the media have made an industry out of Central American dehumanization. In other words, you don't really see three-dimensional people, even in the liberal reporting around, say, child separation. I did a study of, and I included in the book, of the child separation story in 2018, in which that was one of the biggest stories of the year, according to Media Matters and others who study these things. And I looked at it with some volunteers from the perspective of, what is the sourcing for this story? Who are the sources? How many Central American scholars, like Lacey Abrego, Suyapa Portillo, Jorge Cuellar, or Steve Osuna, to name just a few, are in these stories? How many community leaders like Larissa Cuadra and Marta Arevalo in Los Angeles are in the book? How many Central American lawyers? How many Central American community leaders? I mean, and the volunteers and I found a grand total of zero in all of the major media. So you're basically consuming images of Central Americans that are two-dimensional images of pain and sound bites of suffering. And so my mission with the book was to, you know, give a three-dimensional reality to the reality that I have known for all my life. Unlike Joan Didion, who concluded that after 2 weeks, mostly spent in the embassy, the US embassy in El Salvador, concluded that terror is the given of the place. In my 56 years, I concluded that love is also the given of the place. And so in search of that love, which was not difficult to find, I go actually into the different underworlds that have characterized Salvadoran life. Underworlds like the underworlds of the gangs. You know, I go to the top leadership in the book. I meet with like one of a handful of leaders that speak for all 70,000 gang members of MS-13 and 18th Street in kind of this political commission that they have. I go to secret hideouts. I go to my past in the clandestine part of my life. Unbeknownst to most, even you and others, Sonali, when you were interviewing me, I was a former urban commando with the FMLN guerrillas. I've never been out about that because I'm not going to get a Pulitzer grant to write about El Salvador if I tell them, hey, I was an urban commando, by the way. It's a very different treatment you get if you're an ex-Marine or an ex-US Army person, right? So I go into the underworld of the FMLN. I go into the underworld of my father's past. My father, I still live in San Francisco. My office is here on Mission Street in the neighborhood called The Mission, which is the historic core of the Latino community and the Salvadorans. And my father, just down the street from here, like four blocks, used to be at the center of the criminal kind of underworld of contraband in The Mission. And so I go into that and the shame that it brought me and how I came to understand how my dad, who had a very violent temperament and affected me in different ways, was, and what was this mystery that my father had in his life that I never knew for 70 something years. I can't reveal it because I want the reader to experience it, but I can just tell you and guarantee you my father's story is astonishing when you hear it. And I understood my father in a whole different way, and I bring the reader on that journey.
So when we look at the situation today that has driven so many families, parents with young children to the United States looking for a better life, another huge blind spot, of course, has been how U.S. policies historically have helped prop up those institutions in Central American nations that have now fomented violence. That history is very much ignored. Certainly it's ignored by the Trump administration. Unfortunately, it's very much ignored by the liberal media as well. A lot of it having to do around how the U.S. basically exported violence in one way by deporting disaffected youth, but also by, of course, arming and training government forces in nations like El Salvador, right?
Absolutely, Sonali. Woven throughout my narrative that jumps over different periods of time is the story of what I call the heart of darkness, right? Because that's the metaphor that Joan Didion used from Joseph Conrad to describe Salvadorans, the heart of darkness. And that's been the prevailing metaphor, the prevailing trope that has defined us in the English language. And so, you know, I, being a writer, I said, well, okay, that's kind of fake and excuse my language. I inverted it. I went to the heart of darkness that is the US Pentagon's training of the Salvadoran death squads and military responsible for killing 80,000 people. I then follow that heart of darkness as it comes back after the war to train US police forces in counterinsurgency. So when you're looking at Rampart, and we all remember in Los Angeles, for example, the Rampart scandal, the biggest scandal in police history in the United States at the time. And the way that we found out that LAPD was murdering gang members, paralyzing them, shooting in the back, torturing them, robbing banks, dealing drugs, providing protection services for hip hop artists, and possibly even assassinating Biggie Smalls, for example. And so this counterinsurgency policing was enabled by Pentagon trainers from El Salvador and other countries going to LA, going to Portland, going to different police departments to train them. And then during the LA riots, this gets an even greater escalation when a guy named Attorney General William Barr starts redeploying 300 FBI agents away from fighting foreign threats to fighting gangs as the war on gangs is born after the LA riots. And I track that heart of darkness. I track the way that LAPD, Barr, and Barr's Immigration and Naturalization Service joined forces to then deport gangs to El Salvador to create a problem that didn't exist in El Salvador, the problem of the gang structures. And so then Bill Barr also exports US-style policing to El Salvador. And so you see these circuits of counterinsurgency policing that we're actually, many of us are fighting now through Black Lives Matter, right? And like when I see, say those people being kidnapped in Portland, right? I was pursued by death squads. I had men just dressed just like those in unmarked vehicles without name tags, try to pick me up and take me away to slaughter me, cut me up to pieces or something. Fortunately, we escaped thanks to my partner at the time, which is in the book. But when I see that, I see the Salvadorization of US policing, because you know the country's starting to resemble El Salvador in terms of the distinction, the wealth gap between the richest and the poorest is greater here now than it is in El Salvador. So again, I'm telling a story that's a Salvadoran and a US story, because remember, I was born here. I joined the FMLN. I went down to El Salvador and I dedicated a lot of my life to this community, but I'm born here just blocks from where I'm at right now on Folsom Street.
Roberto, when we, so in telling this history about how William Barr, who was once before the Attorney General of the United States, before he became Trump's Attorney General as well, there's this continuum of figures that have participated in the project that has led to our current situation. But I want to bring in some presidents as well, not just Ronald Reagan, but then, of course, many, many years later, Barack Obama. I know you have never shied away from criticizing liberal presidents and conservative presidents alike. What role have those two presidents, who are considered, you know, icons to their respective political fans, what role have they played in the situation that just we don't hear enough about?
Reagan and Obama?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people don't remember, but Barack Obama has expressed his fandom of Ronald Reagan. Right, and you have this, you know, I'm not the kind of person, as you know, Sonali, as you mentioned, I've never been one to see this Maginot line between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And it has a lot to do with being Salvadoran and of Salvadoran descent and being born in the US. I can remember, I've seen, and in my book, I travel like 2,500 miles of mass graves, of war, of genocide, narco violence and gang violence, and US policing that have, you know, killed lots of people. And so, you know, and this was a bipartisan project. My book opens in Karnes, Texas, in that prison that was built and staffed and funded, child prison and mother prison, by Barack Obama. And so I've never been one to create a distinction between these two parties, because the destruction of Salvadoran life and identity has been a bipartisan project. That's why I call my book, I had to go to Greek philosophy and then German philosophy to find my title, which is Unforgetting, which comes from a word, aletheia in ancient Greek. It refers to the underworld journey into that the dead had to take on before they either went to Elysium or Hades. And so before you went into one of those, the dead had to go into the Lethe River, which is the river of forgetting. And the river of forgetting meant that going in there meant that you had to forget who you were in life. And so there's a parallel for that for me, in terms of rescuing what was forgotten. And that parallel and that concept of unforgetting was taken on by modern philosophers of fascism, like Hannah Arendt, who she and others started seeing unforgetting as a way to excavate those truths lost in the darkness of the past that the elites want us to forget. So unforgetting is a way of finding those truths that make the powerful and the rich uncomfortable. So my book and my life I've tried to live have been about that, about afflicting the comfortable with the truths of the past and of the present so that we can have a better future.
Finally, Roberto, I know that you were one of the vocal critics around the book American Dirt by Janine Cummings. And as a Central American writer, as a writer from whose family is from Central America, you've also worked hard to ensure the visibility of Latino, Latina writers like yourself. And I'm wondering if you feel that that conversation around Janine Cummings' book was a turning point in the publishing industry here in the United States, where stories by people like yourself might finally start to be getting more visibility.
Well, as far as the industry goes, we'll see. They've made significant changes at Macmillan, the publisher of that awful book, right? You know, Miriam Gerber and David Bowes, and I founded Lidia Literaria. I kind of conceptualized it and saw what they were doing, and then we joined forces. So there is some movement afoot. There's writers that I know of who are getting better contracts than those of us in the pre-Lidia Literaria era got, which is great, right? I just talked to one who got a real good deal, but, thanks to what we did. And so, that's the industry, but that change will come slower. But the immediate change and the most measurable change is in the heart of Latinos, Latinx peoples ourselves. I think there's a sense that we can no longer be denied. And we know from COVID, we know from the El Paso shooting, I know from Salvadoran experience in 30 years that there's a direct connection between the story you tell about me and your ability to kill me or to torture me or to pass awful policies against me. And so I've always taken to storytelling that way. And that's been one of my big motivations for writing Unforgetting, which was to draw out like the best part of myself. I was the best part of myself. One of the best parts of myself is the part that sacrificed up to the point of even risking my life for others so that El Salvador could be a better country so that we could try to overthrow that US-backed government. I think right now, at a time like we are right now, where we're not going to liberal or progressive our way out of Trumpism, the decline of the economy, COVID-19. I mean, even if we were to somehow manage these, we then have to have the fight of our lives, which is climate change. So in order to face this, I decided to come out literally about the secret that I've held for 25 years about being in the FMLN. What was it like to be a guerrilla? I want young people right now to develop what sociologists call a millenarian sensibility, which is kind of a just visionary, powerful commitment to change the world to the point of sacrificing everything you can, because that's what we're going to need right now to face the challenges. And so I wrote Unforgetting as a kind of a gift, my gift to young people in the best of my ability to share a story of a heart that beat to a revolutionary beat, right? And so, there's a connection between the stories we tell about ourselves. So my story is a way for me to rescue the Salvadoran story lost in the darkness of U.S. English language discourse about us, but it's also a gift because I think people have to, once you understand Salvadoran, you realize we are a ferocious people. We have an incredible history, a beautiful, illuminated, luminescent, powerful history, and one that I think is going to be more apparent as others come and follow my book, which is the first published by one of the big five publishers in the English language as a nonfiction book by and about Salvadorans.
Well, Roberto, I want to congratulate you and thank you so much for joining us and spending this time with us. Best of luck with the book.
Thank you, Sonali, as always.
My guest has been Roberto Lovato. He's a journalist, a member of the Writers Grotto, one of the country's leading writers and thinkers on Central American gangs, refugees, violence, and other issues, co-founder of Dignidad Literaria, The national movement formed to combat the invisibility and silencing of Latinx stories and books in the U.S. publishing industry. We've been talking about his new book, Unforgetting, a memoir of family, migration, gangs, and revolution in the Americas. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.